What I hope to do tonight is finish up the series on the parables from Matthew 20 to Matthew 26, where Yeshua is talking about his second coming. The first one we started with was the laborers in the vineyard. The message there was God gets to decide who he's generous to, and the fact that the people think they deserve more than God thinks they deserve is not binding on him. He is generous when he wants to be and not when he doesn't. Then we had the business of who's going to sit where in the kingdom. And then we did the parable of the tenants, where he's talking about two things, I think. Certainly one thing directly, which is the tenants are the religious elite of Judaism, who are not giving him the fruit due to him from his vineyard. So he's going to replace them. And then meaning number two is the powers and principalities in heaven, who are of the opinion if they kill the son and the heir, they will have the vineyard. That, of course, as we know, doesn't turn out to be true. Then we have the wedding feast, where those who were invited gave all sorts of transparent excuses why they couldn't come. All of this is by way of talking to the religious elite of Judaism, who expects they are God's chosen people, which they are, that they're going to be first in line, and he's saying, don't count on it. And then we did the woes to the scribes and the Pharisees. Again, it's the idea that he's talking to the religious elite and explaining to them what's going on. Then we did Matthew 24, which are the signs of his coming. And he gives a whole list of things that are not signs of his coming, that will upset people and cause people to say, the end is here and all that kind of stuff. And he says, no, my coming the second time will not be subtle at all. The whole world is going to hear the gospel because an angel is going to fly overhead and tell them all. There's going to be a trumpet, and I'm going to come in the clouds and so forth. So now we're actually going to pick it up at 24:45, which we probably talked about last time. But we've got three parables here of what he expects his people to be doing in the interim between the time he leaves and the time he comes back. So the three parables, starting in Matthew 24:45, who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has set over his household to give them their food at the proper time? Blessed is that servant whom his master will find so doing when he comes. So the idea is the master has set agents, if you will, over his household, and he expects those agents to be doing what he told them to do when he gets back. Verse 47, truly I say to you, he will set him over all his possessions. But if that wicked servant says to himself, my master is delayed, and begins to beat his fellow servants and eat and drink with drunkards, the master of that servant will come on a day when he does not expect him, and at an hour he does not know, and will cut him in pieces and put him with the hypocrites. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. So the idea of people who are in the kingdom, they are his disciples, and if they're doing what they're supposed to do while he's gone, he will reward them richly when he comes back. If they're not, he will be upset with them to the extent that he may throw them out of the kingdom. Now, one of the things that is useful to know is these servants are, in a sense, agents, because we're going to read the parable of the talents and so forth, and the idea there is he has set people over his goods, and they are to manage his goods while he's gone. It is perfectly proper and expected for those agents to derive their living off of the master's wealth. They are not expected to do this at their own expense. They'll be entrusted with stuff. So in the first one here, the wise servant whom the master has set over his household to give them their food at the proper time. The idea is This is a guy that's managing the household of the master, and he's supposed to take care of the other servants. Well, in that process, he gets to eat too. And there's nothing at all wrong with that. It's expected. The problem becomes when he says, the master isn't going to come back in my lifetime, and starts taking more than he should, and starts going off in the wrong direction and carousing with the wrong kinds of people. And at that point, when the master comes back, the master is going to be grumpy. So all three of these parables that we're going to do tonight have to do with what are you expected to be doing while he's gone, and what are the standards while he's gone. The comment was, this is all an analogy, and when he's talking about giving them food, he's talking about the work. And certainly that would be included. But as we go forward, we'll see that it also involves sustenance, feeding the poor, clothing the naked, caring for other people. So it isn't just preaching, although that is certainly part of it, I agree with you. It's more than that. You're supposed to feed the hungry, clothe the poor, visit the prisoners. In other words, you're supposed to care for each other, both physically and spiritually. Coming back to another parable that we're not going to do tonight, he says that the servant who knows what he's supposed to do and doesn't do it will receive a severe beating. The servant who doesn't know what he's supposed to do and also doesn't do it will receive a light beating. So the assumption here is someone who is set over his household is experienced, knows what he's doing, has got sufficient instruction, and then if he goes off the rails and starts plundering the household, then the master, when he comes back, is going to be seriously grumpy. And I don't know whether we're going to be cutting him up and throwing him out or not, but it's not going to be pleasant for him. And all of this has to do with people who should know what's going on. So we get to the parable of the 10 virgins. Then the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish and 5 were wise. So the first thing we've set up is we've got 10 virgins. I'm not sure why we're choosing virgins here. I just don't know the answer to that, unless it has something to do with the wedding feast, and I'm not sure what. And as I say, I don't know why that's the metaphor. So 5 of them were foolish and 5 wise. So he has set it up so that 5 of them are foolish, as opposed to those who are wise. For when the foolish took their lamps, they took no oil with them. In other words, they grabbed their lamps with whatever oil happened to be in the reservoir and headed out, whereas the wise ones took extra oil with them. So, but the wise took flasks of oil with their lamps. As the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy and slept. Notice everybody slept. It wasn't just the foolish ones that slept. Everybody goes to sleep. Slightly different metaphors, and what was being taught here is preparation as opposed to expectation, if you will. So the parables that say, stay alert, stay awake. When he comes back, if he finds you awake, he's going to be cool. If he finds you asleep, he's going to be grumpy. Those are talking about expectation. Are you expecting him back? Here, everybody's expecting him. People get tired, they go to sleep. No harm, no foul in this particular parable, because the lesson here is not about expectation so much as it is about preparation. Verse 5 again. As the bridegroom was delayed, they all became drowsy and slept. But at midnight there was a cry. Here is the bridegroom, come out to meet him. Then all those virgins rose and trimmed their lamps. And the foolish said to the wise, give us some of your oil, for our lamps are going out, which indicates that the lamps have been burning all the time they've been asleep. So everybody's lamp at this point is out of oil. And so the question then becomes, who's got oil to put in the lamp to continue? Verse 9. But the wise answered, saying, since there will not be enough for us and for you, go rather to the dealers and buy for yourselves. And while they were going to buy, the bridegroom came. And those who were ready went in with him to the marriage feast, and the door was shut. Afterwards, the other virgins came also, saying, Lord, Lord, open to us. But he answered, truly I say to you, I do not know you. Watch therefore, for you do not know the day or the hour. And this echoes chapter 24, where the idea is nobody knows the day or the hour. And of course, as you've all read Paul, a lot of his letters sound like he expects Yeshua back during his own lifetime. They have that kind of a feeling. And of course, it's been a couple thousand years at this point. So the point here is planning and preparation. The message there is you don't know how long it's going to be until the bridegroom comes. And since you don't know how long it's going to be, don't assume that one load of oil is going to get you there. The wise ones, since nobody knows what time the bridegroom is going to come, they said, this could be a long time or it could be a short time. So I'm going to take some oil with me. As opposed to the foolish ones who were sort of expecting him back at a reasonable hour, quote unquote, whatever that is. They just took what they had and went. They didn't do any preparation. And the message here is preparation, wisdom, prepare for the long haul because it may be that. And of course, as we say, we've been 2,000 years for us. So the next one is the parable of the talents. And this one is almost the same as the parable of the minas in Luke 19. So we may bounce back and forth between those two parables. For it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted them his property. To one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, to another 1, each according to his ability, and he went away. Now the key there is each according to his ability. So he looks at his servants and says, all right, you're a good manager, you're diligent, etc. I will give you more to manage than this other guy who is not quite as sharp and perhaps not quite as diligent. In other words, he's not expecting more of them than they should be able to do. And I think that's an important note there is God does not expect more of you than you should be able to do. And the problem with humans is we don't think we can do as much as we are able to do. That's one of the big takeaways from this. Now, flip over to Luke 19:11, which is a similar parable. 2 different venues, 2 different audiences. The Luke parables are given as he's going to Jerusalem. The parable of the talents is after the briefing on the Mount of Olives, which indicates that he is in Jerusalem as he does this. The audience in the Matthew parables, I expect the audience are his disciples. Here, the audience is whoever happens to be there. He's at Zacchaeus' house, so a random audience. So Luke 19:11. As they heard these things, he proceeded to tell a parable. Because he was near to Jerusalem and because they supposed that the kingdom of God was to appear immediately. So the expectation of the people there is he is on his way to take over as King of Kings. He said, therefore, a nobleman went into a far country to receive for himself a kingdom and then return. Obviously, that's he is going to be crucified and die, and he's going to go into a heaven where he will receive his kingdom, and then he will return. Calling 10 of his servants, he gave them 10 minas and said to them, engage in business until I come. But his citizens hated him and sent a delegation after him saying, we do not want this man to reign over us. When he returned, having received the kingdom, he ordered those servants to whom he gave the money to be called to him, that he might know what they had gained by doing business. The first came to him and saying, Lord, your mina has made 10 minas more. All right, so now the deal here is there are 10 minas, 10 servants, one mina per servant. We only get three of those servants reporting in this parable. So the first one multiplied it by 10. The second one multiplied it, I believe, by 5. And then the third one didn't do anything with it. So the two parables in Matthew and Luke are somewhat parallel, but not quite. In the Luke parable, the setup is he's going away to receive his kingdom. In the parable of the talents, it is, what do I expect you to be doing while I'm gone? And in fact, that's the case in both of those parables. And notice, by the way, in the Matthew parable, he has three servants, and each of them gets a different amount of wealth depending on the master's opinion of his ability. Whereas in the Luke parable, each one got the same amount. 10 servants, each of them got one mina. Because there's two different lessons here. Lesson number one is, I expect you all to be doing stuff while I'm gone, and it's going to be a while before I get back. And, oh, by the way, the people who are going to crucify me don't want me to reign over them. That's the setup on the Luke parable. The setup on the parable of the talents in Matthew is he has divided his wealth according to his opinion of the ability of his people. The end of it is the same. He's going to come back and demand an accounting, and he is going to handle his servants differently depending upon what they did with the talents that he gave them. So now we're back in Matthew, and we'll pick it up at verse 16. He who had received the 5 talents went at once and traded them and made 5 talents more. In the Matthew parable, he doubled it. In the Luke parable, he increased it by 10 times. So also, he who had the 2 talents made 2 talents more. So both of the servants doubled what he left with them. And the master's opinion of their ability is he invested it proportionately depending on what he thought their talent was. Both of them did a good job. They doubled what they had. But presumably the one who got 5 was a better manager, if you will, because he had more irons in the fire than the guy who only had 2. Verse 18, but he who had received the 1 talent went and dug in the ground and hid his master's money. Now after a long time, the master of those servants came and settled accounts with him. So notice in both parables, there is going to be a reckoning. He expects to know what you did with what he left you with. 20. And he who had received the 5 talents came forward, bringing 5 talents more, saying, Master, you delivered to me 5 talents. Here I have made 5 talents more. And his master said to him, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful in a little. Now I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master. And as I said earlier, during the administration of the 5 talents, it is absolutely expected that the one who is managing that money will take his living from it. Just like your son is in the brokerage business, and it is absolutely proper for him to make his living from the people whose money he is investing. And it's the same here. The only problem is, at the end of the day, when he comes back and he says, you gave me 5, here's 10. So his living expenses are not in that extra 5. What I'm saying is he made more than 10, because I am sure he lived quite nicely while the master was gone. And that's appropriate. Use, again, our stockbroker analogy. A stockbroker who is really good and manages, $500 or $600 million worth of other people's money will live much better than a stockbroker who only manages 100,000 of other people's money, because the surplus, if you will, is much greater. And that is entirely appropriate, nothing sinister about it whatsoever. The problem becomes when the manager is dishonest and starts eating up his client's wealth, then you've got a problem. But for the manager to live proportionately to the amount that is invested with him is perfectly fine. 22. And he also, who had the two talents, came forward saying, "Master, you delivered to me two talents. Here I have made two talents more." His master said to him, "Well done, good and faithful servants. You have been faithful over a little. I will set you over much. Enter into the joy of your master." And notice that from the master's perspective, 10 talents is change. I have got something more for you to be set over that will make this 10 talents that I gave you look like change. The reward that you're going to get is something even greater, and again, proportional to what you were trusted with. 24. He also who had received the one talent came forward saying, "Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. So I was afraid, and I went and hid your talent in the ground. Here you have what is yours." But the master answered him, "You wicked and slothful servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I gathered no seed? Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming I should have received what was my own with interest." Now, a couple of obvious things here. First off, fear. The guy who received one talent, A, was less talented, no pun intended, than the guys who received more. He was not given more than the master expected him to be able to handle. Thing two, he is expected to trade and invest with it. Trading and investing involve the possibility of loss. In other words, you can make a perfectly sound investment and a war can break out and the ship that you invested in can get sunk. That is a risk of doing business. The third guy was not willing to accept that risk because he was afraid of the master. If I invest this one talent in a cargo ship and I send the cargo ship to Kittim and on its way back it gets sunk and I have lost my talent because the ship has hit the bottom of the ocean, I don't want to face him in that case. The master understands this. He has got a large amount of money, and he did not get that large amount of money by not understanding how money works. And the way money works is it only increases when you put it to work. So you have to invest, you have to buy a vineyard or buy a ship or buy goods and trade them and so forth. And if you buy a vineyard, for example, it's entirely possible that we'll have a swarm of locusts and a drought, and you may lose everything. That's certainly possible. But as this guy says, if you don't do anything, you get nothing back. And the master is obviously grumpy with him. The operative word here is he was afraid. And he wasn't willing to take normal business risks for fear that he might fail. And if he did fail, the master was going to be really upset with him. Well, because he took no risk, the master is really upset with him. That's because he doesn't understand the character of the master. And as I say, the master is no fool. He hasn't given this guy more than he can handle. And the master also clearly understands money and understands the risk of these things. The message here is you're given talents and God expects you to use those talents to go out and accept some risk as opposed to sitting on your blessed assurance and not doing anything. The comment was, why does it say of the master, he who had received the one talent came forth saying, "Master, I knew you to be a hard man, reaping where you did not sow and gathering where you scattered no seed. We actually don't know anything about the master. This is the servant's impression of the master. And clearly, the other two managers have a different opinion of the master. Let me take you to another parable. This one's in Luke, and it's the parable of the dishonest manager. I'm not going to go read it, but I will synopsize it. You have a property manager, and he's managing a ranch, for lack of a better term, and the owner of the ranch gets word back that this guy is wasting his resources. And he says to him, "You, go get the books, bring them to me. You are done being a manager." So he has an opportunity here in the interim between when the master says, "Go get the books," and he shows up with the books in his hand. What he does is he goes out to the tenant farmers and he adjusts their rent in order to gain favor with the tenants so that when he is fired, he will be welcome in their home. That's basically the setup. And when he gets back and the master sees that he has reduced the amount of rent of his tenants, the master, instead of being grumpy, says, "Wow, you are really smart. And wiser are the children of men than the children of the kingdom," or words to that effect. Now the question becomes, why does the master react that way? Because he has just been robbed. And the thing that the servant is counting on is the character of the master. It is entirely possible for the master to say, "You, thief, call the bailiff, put him in jail, make him repay everything." The master is within his rights to do that. He doesn't. And the manager, knowing the character of the master, realizes that the master will not do that. So the question becomes, why? And the answer to that, I think, and I got this from Kenneth Bailey, by the way, in his book, Poet and Peasant, which is a good book. The tenants don't know that the manager has been fired. Because if they're in collusion with the manager to gyp the landowner, they will lose their lease and they will never get any agriculture again. So the whole story depends on the tenants believing that the manager is still authorized to do what he's doing. I've never met a farmer that wasn't pessimistic. "Oh, there's not enough rain. Oh," you know, that kind of thing. So the idea of each of the tenants being okay with the reduction, they are thinking that the property manager has recognized that, well, we didn't get much rain this year, or, wow, the bugs have been bad, and what he's doing is he's taking care of them. So they're going into town and they're saying, "Wow, look what they just did for me." So everybody is happy with the landowner, happy with the manager, and the landowner now has, if he didn't already, have a reputation in the town of being generous, of being fair. And so when the steward comes back with the books and he realizes what's happened, he also realizes how much goodwill in the village has just been purchased for him. Hence, he doesn't throw the manager in jail. He just looks at him and says, "Okay, you're still fired, but I understand what you did." So the idea here is the dishonest manager knows the character of the owner and depends on it. So he depends on the owner reacting just exactly as he reacts, instead of saying, "Wait a minute, all you tenants, get back here. We're going to get your rent back up where it used to be, and I'm going to throw this guy in jail." And at that point, he looks like the bad guy. The dishonest manager knows the character of the master and trades on it. Back now to the talents. The two servants who took their money and invested also know the character of the master. These are people that have been in that household long enough for the master to know their capabilities and say, "Okay, you're trustworthy with 10 talents. You're trustworthy with 5. You're trustworthy with 1, whatever the numbers are. So they know the master and the master knows them. So what I'm suggesting to you is, yes, the opinion of the guy who only got one may in fact be the opinion of somebody who is disgruntled anytime he meets somebody more successful. You've met people like that. If somebody is more successful, they, oh yeah, probably crook, probably stole it. That kind of an attitude. The other two servants don't have that kind of an attitude. I'm speculating here, obviously, but certainly the master is a good businessman because he has accumulated all that wealth. And he didn't get it all by being a patsy. So yes, he's probably shrewd. Yes, he is probably pretty straightforward in business. And the guy with the one talent interprets that as being shady, whereas nobody else does. The comment was, reaping where you don't sow, he has given his servants some amount of money, and he then reaps what they make off of his money. So the third guy may regard that as reaping where you don't sow. It's certainly possible, but again, we're talking about large amounts of money, and we're talking about people who understand trade and investing. So if that's what you want to think, go ahead, but I don't find that particularly persuasive. So let's pick it up at 26 again. But his master answered him, "You wicked and slothful servant, you knew that I reap where I have not sown and gather where I have not scattered seed." In my translation, there's a question mark there, as in, this is what you think of me? Then you ought to have invested my money with the bankers, and at my coming I should have received what was my own with interest. So take the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For to everyone who has, more will be given, and he will have an abundance. But from the one who has not, even what he has will be taken away. And cast the worthless servant into the outer darkness. In that place there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Now, the other parable over in Luke, the guy said, wait a minute, master, he has 10 and the other one has 5. What are you doing that? And the thing about that is the money belongs to the master. It doesn't belong to the servant. The master is simply investing his asset where he gets the best return, just like any wise manager would. The idea of that money being taken away from the worthless servant means that he has no more wealth to manage and so is not able to gain his living from managing the wealth as would be a successful manager. The other thing that I see in this, which is even stronger, this is an absolute condemnation of pietism. Pietism, for those who don't know, are people who basically look at salvation as, I am saved, I'm going to sit on my blessed assurance, and it doesn't matter if I'm just a gatekeeper in heaven, as long as I know I'm there. And they don't do anything other than sit on their blessed assurance. And what these parables are saying is that is absolutely wrong. What he's saying is everybody has got talents, and it's a nice pun, that God has invested in you. And while he's gone, he expects you to use those talents in service to him and increasing the kingdom, saying, I've said the sinner prayer, I've been baptized, and now I'm going to sit here quietly and not make any waves until I either get raptured out of here or I die. That's very poor theology. And sadly, lots of the American church has fallen into that, where the emphasis has shifted from doing stuff in God's kingdom to getting people to say the sinner's prayer so we get them to heaven and then dumping them. So now let's quickly do the sheep and the goats and we'll be done. So this is now on his return. When the Son of Man comes in glory and all the angels with him, then he will sit on his glorious throne. Before him will be gathered all the nations, and he will separate people one from another as a shepherd separates the sheep from the goats. And he will place the sheep on his right and the goats on his left. Then the king will say to those on his right, come, "You who are blessed by my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. For I was hungry, and you gave me food, and I was thirsty, and you gave me drink. I was a stranger, and you welcomed me. I was naked, and you clothed me. I was sick, and you visited me. I was in prison, and you came to me." Then the righteous will answer him, saying, "Lord, when did we see you hungry and feed you, or thirsty and give you drink? And when did we see you a stranger and welcome you, or naked and clothe you? And when did we see you sick or in prison and visit you?" And the king will answer them, "Truly I say to you, as you did to one of the least of these my brothers, you did to me." So, first off, notice who he is separating, the nations. So this is everybody. And by the time of his return, as we've said before, the gospel will have gone to the entire world. And again, I see this as a condemnation of pietism. What he's saying is, if you aren't doing kingdom stuff while I'm gone, I am going to be upset with you. Feed the poor, clothe the naked, visit those in prison, visit people who are sick, which brings to mind at the Last Supper, says, people will know you're my disciples by your love, which, as I am very fond of saying, the definition of love is in the Torah. It is not a feeling, it's behavior. How do you behave towards one another? It doesn't matter whether you got good feelings and get all goosey when you see them, it's what do you physically do for them? James says the same thing, faith without works is dead. All of this I see as a condemnation of pietism. Verse 41, then he will take those on his left. Depart from me, you cursed, into the eternal fire prepared for the devil and his angels. For I was hungry, and you gave me no food. I was thirsty, and you gave me no drink. I was a stranger, and you did not welcome me. Naked, and you did not clothe me. Sick and in prison, and you did not visit me. Then they also will answer, saying, Lord, when did we see you hungry or thirsty or a stranger or naked or sick or in prison and did not minister to you? Then he will answer them, saying, truly I say to you, as you did not do it to one of the least of these, you did not do it to me. And these will go away into eternal punishment, but the righteous into eternal life. Notice, they're looking at the king, and they're saying, well, I mean, if we'd seen you, we'd have done all that. Which is to say, they don't do it generally. They are doing it to somebody of influence. If Yeshua showed up and he wanted a drink of water, oh, that's the Lord. Boy, let's get him a bucket full. Because they are recognizing who he is. And what they're not recognizing is that the instructions are to care for each other. Sort of the same thing as he said, if a rich man comes into your synagogue and he's got a gold ring on his finger and you say, hey, take this great seat here. And if a poor man shows up, you say, go sit down over there out of the way. It's the same message. Everybody in God's kingdom has value. Different value. We're not all the same, but we all have value and we're expected to care for each other. So what we've done here is we started off talking about who's going to be in the kingdom. And the message there is to the religious elite, thinking that they're going to be at the front of the line, and him saying, no, that isn't true. And to his own disciples, don't worry about where you're going to sit. My Father will decide where you sit, and that isn't up to me. Just go do what I told you to do. And we have the signs of the end, where he tells you, don't be distracted by all of the stuff that happens in this world, false messiahs and all that kind of stuff, because when I come back, there's not going to be any doubt in anybody's mind. And if you have any doubt whatsoever about whether this guy or that guy is the messiah or whatever, he's not. If there's any possible doubt whatsoever, the answer is no. Then, of course, he talks about what he wants us to be doing while he's gone. Comment was, with the 10 virgins, without really saying it, he's taking a swipe at the rapture mavens. And that is possible. I see it as against pietism. And of course, rapture mavens tend to also be pietists. So we may have a twofer there. I don't know. But the idea is they're sort of expecting how long it's going to be. And so they bring the lamps that are burning, and we're expecting he's going to be there before the lamps go out. And they don't. One last comment. In every one of these, when he comes back, he is holding people to high standards. He is not this soft, gooey, squishy Jesus guy. This is the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. And he is looking at his kingdom and looking at the people in his kingdom, and he is saying, you haven't behaved well. Out. You've done well. Come in and enter by joy. But there is definite, serious judgment happening here. I was reading a piece by Andrew Clavin, and John Wayne, when he was on his deathbed, people came to visit him and comfort him as he was dying. And a Jew that he knew came up, and his son, who was there, says, I'm not sure he wants to see a Jew right now. And Wayne says, no, he's fine. It's the Jew up there that I'm not in any hurry to see, which I kind of like. The comment was that a lot of people who are in the Sunday church look at that and say, when the master takes from the guy that didn't invest and gave it to the... They said, wow, wait a minute. He's got 10. What are you doing? That isn't fair. And the whole point there is it's the master's money. And he's investing it where he gets the best return for him because we are all his servants. So what he wants us to do is be profitable servants. The guy that buried the talent was responsible. In other words, he didn't want to lose that money. It's not like he's gone out and caroused and drink and wasted it. He's hanging on to that because he knows he's got to give it back. So he's not actually irresponsible. He's just not profitable. And the reason he's not profitable is because he's afraid. Fear has paralyzed him. And he doesn't understand the character of the master. The master understands that there's risk in doing business. And he's terrified that he will be blamed. In other words, he's a bureaucrat. Nothing a bureaucrat hates more than being criticized. All my years in the Army, one of the things that I constantly heard, oh, we'd get criticized if we did that. That's sort of his attitude. And at the end of the day, the master doesn't say, oh, you poor guy, oh, I understand. Oh, well, I got it. Yeah, no, it's out of the pool. And that's the thing that upsets people.